welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore-Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book In Broken Water by Adelard Coles. We're on the fifth chapter, and this is the fourth part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 5 continued. The days that followed were not exactly happy. We were pestered with officialdom and spent most of the time arguing with them. To add to our troubles, the heat wave arrived from America, and we had overwhelming heat by day and by night. The harbour at Norderney is 2 miles from the front, where our hotel was situated, so 2 or 3 times a day I had to toil down a long, dusty road. Everything in the yacht had to be turned out and the inventory carefully checked. Clothes had to be washed and the cabin dried and cleaned up. A new forehatch had to be made, as the thieves had heaved the original one overboard. We took the opportunity of getting the pump mended, as it had been faulty for some time, but the German mechanic succeeded in making it worse than ever. When Annette was stolen, her captors had let the dinghy go adrift, and it was picked up by some enterprising fishermen. 4 of them carried her down to the harbour and put in a salvage claim for £1. I refused this, and they threatened to go to court and claim the 10% to which they were entitled. They were a little wrathful when I gave them the 10%, allowed and proved the dinghy without sculls to be worth only £5. Altogether, it was an exceedingly trying time, and we got heartily sick of the business. Buster was the best of us in dealing with the people and officials, but as I was skipper of the yacht, the whole fuss fell on my shoulders, and I was particularly busy. Half of Norderney seemed to want to see me for something or other connected with the police, the hotel, or the fitting out of Annette. We were, of course, quite at the mercy of the police, who not only held our money and our passports, but could at any time have tied us up by red tape and detained our ship. Generally speaking, people treated us rather well. Several strangers offered to lend us money when our ship was stolen. An offer from the Swedish army captain we had met was particularly appreciated. His leave was up, and he said if we cared to accept a small loan, we could post on our debt to him afterwards. His offer was declined, as I had wired to England for cash, but it struck me that it was most extraordinarily trusting and generous on his part. Of course, many shop people offered us loans from a very different motive. The curious thing was that everybody in Norderney seemed to know how much money we had, and also how much we expected from England. When the cash eventually did arrive, we first heard of it from the hotel proprietor and not from the post office. Presently, a postman arrived with a large bag and started counting out millions of marks. The manager had to swear to our identity and sign the receipt for the money on our behalf. This business took place in the private office, but soon the hotel buzzed with the news. We undoubtedly provided Norderney with great entertainment. In the first place, they thought us mad in coming such a long way on so small a boat, and the events that followed our arrival at the island were published in the local newspaper and became the chief topic of conversation. Amongst others, we met an English scientist on his annual holiday from Berlin who wanted us to smuggle saccharin to England. Huge profits, he said, as the duty was 10 times the cost price. I fancy he had other things on his mind besides saccharin, as he hinted that a fortune could be made trafficking between England and Germany. What upset me so terribly was the financial loss we had incurred through the theft of Annette. This nearly brought tears to my eyes, and he assured us it was our duty to make this good at the expense of the British customs. With the income tax at 4 and 6, he felt it would be particularly sinful for us to fail to take advantage of such a golden opportunity of getting our own back on the revenue authorities. He offered to provide the saccharin in small sealed tins which would fit underneath our water tank. We could arrive off an English port at night, sink and buoy the saccharin, and then proceed to declare customs. The night after we had been examined, we should put to sea again, pick up the contraband and proceed to the home port. All of this, of course, was very entertaining. He was, however, interesting in many ways and knew Germany well. We were amused when he had lunch with us one day at the hotel. There were peaches for dessert. Our guest picked up the ones left over in the dish and pocketed them with an apology, saying they were so very nice that, as we had paid for them, it was a pity to leave them for the hotel to sell again. Our scientist was one of those odd characters who belong to no particular country. Some months later, I met him in London, and he again pressed me to buy saccharin, this time to build a special ship to carry £500 worth at a net profit of, say, £3,000. I regret to say that in spite of his mad schemes and obvious unreliability, I nearly got had over a patent he had brought over from Germany and wanted to sell in England. Author's note, 1956. The patent was a wick through the centre of a stick of sealing wax. It may not have been useless, as 30 years later, after the Second World War, I was surprised to see my secretary sealing letters with exactly the same thing. Perhaps I missed a winner. Chapter 6. To the Kiel Canal. On July the 15th, we were free to leave, as we had recovered our money and papers, which had been seized by the police. We were delighted with the prospect of getting clear of Norderney, though a sharp fall in the barometer indicated that the spell of fine weather was ending. We got underway in the afternoon. There was a light southwest wind and a strong tide which carried a net round the western end of Norderney into the Seegat, leading to the bar, which is about a mile offshore. We experienced difficulty in keeping to the channel as the visibility was poor and was rapidly getting poorer. About half a mile from the shore, we heard the dull growl of breaking water and sounded bottom in 1.5 fathoms. We sailed slowly on in a peculiar, unsettled swell, and the water got no shallower. The sky was thickening and the shore out of sight. Suddenly, I saw breakers ahead, showing white through the haze, not only on the bow but to the port and starboard as well. We seemed almost hemmed in, and I put a net about and ran back, setting a compass course for the west end of the island. Then the fog came thick. It was eerie work feeling our way back to Norderney. The incessant roar sounded as though the yacht was surrounded by breakers, and the sea had a most alarming, short, steep roll. We were glad when we picked up one of the tall red spar buoys used in Germany, and the lead showed that we were in deeper water. Suddenly, a gap in the fog revealed the hotels of Norderney, and we found ourselves unpleasantly close to the shore. The rounding of the west end of the island and the finding of the harbour was not difficult after this, as the fog lifted in patches and enabled us to get bearings. We overtook a new German yacht of about 7 tons on the way, but this little success was poor compensation for the miserable prospect of another day in Norderney. That night, there was a heavy thunderstorm which broke up the weather completely. We were really lucky in being in harbour and almost felt cheerful again as we listened to the wind in the rigging, the rumble of thunder, and felt the rain trickling down our necks through some of the numerous leaks round the edge of the cabin top. Next day, the high wind prevailed and it was too rough to put to sea outside the islands, but as the wind was northwest, we determined to try to sail behind the islands, which should offer some protection. We should pass south of Norderney, through the Riftgat, the channel between the sands bordering the island and the immense sand of Hoeth Rif to the south. The chart indicated that the channel was marked by withies on its north side and very shallow halfway along its length, at the watershed, where the tide divides, ebbing to the west on one side and to the east on the other, and flooding in the opposite directions. After passing Norderney, we would cross a Seegat to Baltrum, a small island, repeat the process of following the channel behind the island, into the open again, and then behind Langerug and the other islands, as long as there was enough water. Having cast off just before high water, we made splendid progress, scudding along under trysail and reef jib. The channel was not difficult to follow, and we passed south of Norderney and Baltrum and got safely behind Langerug by 2:30 p.m, where we anchored. The seas across the exposed channels between the islands were rather bad, steep and breaking, especially just west of Langerug, where a net at times was almost unmanageable and made steering very hard. The dinghy also seemed in a bad way, turning broadside on and then nearly capsizing as the painter jerked. I feared we should lose her. We generally used to carry her upside down on the deck, but for some reason we had forgotten to do so that day. Cruising behind the islands is really as dangerous as outside in bad weather, since not only is there the added risk of running aground, but between the islands the waves are hollow and breaking if it is blowing really hard. We had not got a vast amount of provisions, so in the afternoon Dunstable and I set out on a foraging expedition in the dinghy. Our anchorage was somewhat exposed, so we waited for low tide and the protection of the dried-out sands before edging our way gingerly to the shore. The sculls had been lost when the yacht was stolen, and the ones that replaced them were ridiculously short, so that progress against the strong wind was tedious. However, we succeeded at length in making the landing on the sands. We were still about a mile from the shore proper, as it was nearly low tide and the great banks were uncovered. After venturing a few yards, we were obliged to call a halt, as we sank nearly up to our knees in soft mud. The mud was particularly bad near the mussel beds, and as that part of the coast had a reputation for quicksands, we retraced our steps to the dinghy. We could see a sort of landing stage about a mile to the east, so we waded along in the shallow water, holding the bow of the dinghy, except where the mud was too soft and we had to re-embark and fall back on the absurd little oars. We eventually got near the landing stage and walked up to a little village where we bought provisions of a rather poor quality. The expedition took up the whole afternoon, and we got back to Annette at sunset. The next day, July the 17th, we got underway at 10:30 and ran behind Langerug towards Spijkerug. Navigation was similar to the previous day, running along the inside channel, but it was much easier as the sea had moderated. East of Langerug, the wind died away and the yacht was becalmed for a while, until a southwesterly breeze got up. This gave us a free wind out into the North Sea, through the Haal, a wide gap between Langerug and Spijkerug. Once outside, the yacht headed eastwards, offshore of Spijkerug and Wangerug, the most easterly of the Frisian Islands, where course was altered to the northwest to clear the vast areas of sand and shoals which in places extend over 10 miles seaward and lie between the deep estuaries of the Jade, Weser and the Elbe. The distance from the Haal to the Elbe 1 lightship, the outer lightship, is almost 20 miles, so it was fortunate that the wind freshened when Annette passed the Jade Whistleboy, so that she sailed fast. The land lay to starboard low and thus far out of sight, but navigation was quite easy, as there was the outer fairway buoys of the big rivers, which enabled us to check our position from time to time. It was pleasant sailing, marred only by an accidental jibe in which the main sheet carried away the Excelsior log. It was rather a serious loss, as so much of our navigation depended upon it. The Elbe 1 lightship is far out at sea, as the sands here extend to their maximum distance from the German coast, ending in the Scharhorn Reef and the Roben Flat. We could have made a useful shortcut behind these sands, but for the fact that the tide was falling and the sea was getting rough. The shortcut is the one made famous in the Riddle of the Sands. It was the scene of the stranding of the Dulcibella on the East Hohenhorn Sand, either by the west or the east Telte channels, both of which are unbuoyed. Then we would have to find another channel, and finally the Withies marking a narrow gully in the Steel Sands, which joins the Elbe near Cuxhaven. It might have been possible on a rising tide, but as it was, it offered no practical alternative to the long detour outside the Scharhorn. We duly sighted the outer Elbe lightship, but as the ebb had started, it took us a long time to run up the river. I say river, but to all appearances at high water it is open sea. The wind backed to the west-northwest and steadily freshened. The effect of wind over tide made quite a sea in the Elbe, and our progress was so slow that it was dark long before we got into Cuxhaven. We narrowly escaped being run down by two steamers, which both had to slow down their engines for us. But in the end, we safely dropped anchor north of the town in a little bay, as we did not like to try to find our way into the harbour and berth at night. Next morning, we got underway at 11 o'clock on the first of the flood and made rapid progress up the river with the help of the hot tide and freshening wind. We were really carrying too much sail, and a sudden squall brought things to a head, for we were near the edge of the channel and had to jibe. I hurriedly lowered the mainsail half down, but although the utmost care was taken, the boom broke and the power line snapped. Fortunately, we were able to edge across the river to Brunsbüttel, at the entrance to the Kaiser Wilhelm, the Kiel Canal, under the foresail alone. We dropped anchor there to wait for a tug to tow us through the locks, but the hard tide and the fresh wind made it almost impossible to check the anchor chain as it ran out, and the three of us together had a lively time before we managed to get a turn with it round the bollard. There was an astonishing tumble of sea for a place so far up the Elbe, and we had to wait for an hour and a half pitching and rolling before the tug came out to tow us into the locks. Instantly, we were surrounded by tug brokers, so, choosing the two which came first, we arranged to be towed through the canal at 5 o'clock the next morning. Having had a meal ashore in the evening, we turned in for a good sleep before passing through the famous Kaiser Wilhelm, the Kiel, canal. As arranged, we started out the following morning in company with 8 barges and 1 German yacht. It was an easy and an interesting day. The huge girder bridges which span the canal in two places are magnificent feats of engineering, and the whole place gives an impression of immense power and organisation. The steering of Annette was not quite as simple as we had anticipated, since her short keel made her sheer wildly about unless there was a man at the helm. The German yacht with us was a very smart affair, and her crew were constantly worrying about their paint, some of which was lost when the convoy stopped in a siding and their yacht was thrown against the piles as she was brought up. We made Halteneau at the eastern end of the canal at 6:30 p.m. A German warship passed through the locks from the other side, and we noticed that although she may not perhaps have been of a very recent design, she was handled with the loving care usually bestowed upon only children. Everything was well disciplined and regulated, so that she passed through the locks remarkably quickly and without the shouting and confusion usual on the other steamers. The mast of our ship barely reached the quayside, and she appeared a ridiculous little toy, almost lost in the huge basin. We had to wait for the German warship, but after a little delay, a tug towed us out of the canal into the Kiel Fjord. I had made temporary repairs to the boom with two battens of wood lashed together, but it was necessary to have a new one made. My friend, Jolly, from whom I had bought Annette, was building his new, larger yacht to replace her at a place called Heikendorf, near Kiel, so we looked this up on the chart and found it to be a little cove just across the fjord. Accordingly, we set sail, hoping to find a yard where repairs might be effected. Well, we found the yard, and, what was even more pleasing, we found Jolly in his boat, Ingrid. Having made Annette snug for the night, we joined Ingrid's crew and went up a hill to a little inn overlooking the fjord. As can be imagined, there was a lot to talk about after our absence from England for several weeks. We made a party for six for dinner, and, as is the way when meeting fellow countrymen in alien lands, we felt we had known each other all our lives. We spent 4 days at Heikendorf whilst we had the necessary repairs done. A new boom was made and a new pump fitted, and the sculls for the dinghy were replaced by ones of adequate length. We also ordered a new mast to be made, for which we would call to have stepped on our return. The existing mast was too light for the punishment it received in bad weather. The crews of both yachts were very busy, but we managed to foregather for very cheery meals at the inn, where the food and wine were both excellent and cheap. Time passed quickly, and I was extremely busy doing various odd jobs on the ship whilst Dunsterville and Buster went into Kiel for provisions. Things were very cheap in Germany, but all shopping was a serious business, as it entailed endless bargaining and arguing. Fortunately, we had the help of Mr. S., a German ex-officer, who was assisting in taking Ingrid across to England. He got things for us at about half the price we should otherwise have had to pay. The weather since leaving Norderney had been wet, and since arriving at Heikendorf there had been a succession of gales. For some while, the wound in Buster's leg had been giving him trouble, and it was not improved by the constant wetness of the cabin and the cramped conditions under which we were living. On talking it over, we agreed with him it would be better for him to return to England in Ingrid, rather than let it get worse. Dunsterville was a most able mate, and Annette could easily be handled by the two of us, though we should miss Buster's good company and ability to deal sharply with foreigners of doubtful honesty. We had a farewell dinner at the inn. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly, and remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.